Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. I've brought to you some really fascinating personalities, and today I have a good friend, Aditya Gupta. Aditya, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Aditya is the founder chairman of ADMA, managing partner of GEMS, which is a micro VC. He started his career with International Computers Limited, worked in London, Singapore, and UAE. And then he was one of the forerunners of the Indian BPO space when he founded InfoVision. What an amazing journey.
Thank you.
So, Aditya, tell us a little bit about your early career and some of your learnings and challenges.
Great. So, it was in 1976 that I was offered a job in London with a company called International Computers Limited. It was Britain's computer company.
Yep.
So, like IBM was really America's computer company, ICL was the British counterpart. And it was quite coincidental. I was able to go and work with ICL. Fortunately, I was born in London, so I didn't have issues of a visa and all of that, which is usually the impediment most people have. So I worked for ICL in London. I'm a finance person, so I worked as an analyst first, and then went on to become a management accountant. And I worked in London for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And it was in 1980 that my boss came to me one day and said, would you like to go to Singapore?
Okay.
I mean, just out of the blue. And I remember it quite clearly. I said, can I tell you tomorrow? And the answer was yes. So I went to Singapore as ICL's financial controller.
And which year was this?
This was in 1980.
Okay.
So in 1980, I went to Singapore. I worked in Singapore for 2 years, went back to London. Because postings were really between 2 and 3 years. I went back to London, worked in London for about 6 months when they said, well, we'd really like you to go to Abu Dhabi and be the regional financial controller for ICL. Mm-hmm. So, which I did. I went there and during that time, so I spent 3 years in Abu Dhabi as regional and then 2 years in Dubai. Mm-hmm. So that was a 5-year stint there. And it was very exciting because the regional meant, you know, the entire Arab world. Right. And it was a very different world from 82 to the end of 87 when we were there. Yeah. The connectivity that you have today, the convenience of technology wasn't there.
Yeah.
I remember we used to send telexes. I'm sure the older generation.
I have the same vintage.
We are the same vintage.
Yes.
So fax machine and telexes were our mode of communication at that time. So I used to travel quite extensively throughout the Middle East, where our business was. So that was my time with ICL out of India.
Okay.
And then I got asked to come to India as an expat,
okay,
which is, I suppose, the nicest way shoehorned into the country.
Correct.
So I did that. That was in 1980s, end of 87, early 88. And since then, we have been in New Delhi.
Okay.
So that's been the
Then you decided to become an entrepreneur and founded InfoVision.
Correct. So it was in 1991 that I decided that, you know, I'd always had a desire to start a business of my own. So it was in 1991 that I started. And it was really in the area of, we used to call it relationship marketing, and people thought we were a marriage a counseling bureau, because the word customer relationship management, or CRM as we know it today, didn't exist.
Correct.
So that was the idea. So in 1991, I started with a partner that then I went out on my own. And it's been a journey of growth and quite a wonderful journey, I might add, during those 17 years before I sold my business.
So InfoVision must have been, I mean, you must have had an incredible vision to have started BPOs right at the beginning.
Well, you know, Ashutosh, I used to say on my visiting card, India's first CRM company since 1991.
Wow.
And that's not been challenged. So it was one of those early things. I think it was just interesting the whole way it started and how it came together and how we sort of, you know, morphed and pivoted during that journey.
Mm-hmm.
So from just being relationship marketing into call centers, into back office processing, domestic, international. So it was quite a heady 17 years.
And what were some of your learnings and say some of your challenges in those days?
So I must say, I mean, of course, the first challenge was that, you know, in the early, in the 90s, throughout the 90s, telecommunications in our country were terrible,
poor,
right? Very, very poor. And I remember we had to actually find exchanges where you had telephone lines free and start our office and build our you know, capabilities around there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that, you know, we found Gurgaon and there were great offices and we could open it. Mm. So I remember in Delhi, our first center that we started was in Janakpuri, because that was the only exchange that could give us 15 telephone lines.
Incredible.
Right. So it was those. And then, of course, you know, the whole issue of limited technology, people not being available. So, I mean, challenges are there in every business. But I must say, communication was a big issue in those early days.
And expensive.
And very expensive, I might add. I mean, it very, very expensive. But fortunately, this was, you know, you were doing it for a customer, the customer wanted it. So that was an expenditure he was willing to pay for. Yeah.
So, you know, just for all our young listeners, I even remember the rates. To make an international call was 84 rupees a minute.
Yes, sir.
84 rupees in those days.
Right.
Which, and to call Bombay, which today is almost free, was 42 rupees a minute.
Right. And you remember the time when mobile started and we used to pay 16 rupees 80 paisa for a minute of incoming and outgoing. So that was the time we went through.
So moving on, you know, after 17 years of building a global business, you sold it.
Yes.
How did it feel to sell your baby?
Actually, it felt good. And I must add that the reason it felt good was for two or three reasons. One was that it sounds quite odd, but we had grown quite substantially. We had reached just, our total strength was just over 10,000 people. And to manage 10,000 people became very difficult. Secondly, we are not today in the world of VCs. You know, we didn't have a plethora of people coming and saying, you know, here's $1 million, grow the business. So really, the business just owned by me and my wife. And on that basis, it was, you know, it was difficult to continuously finance it. Because as you grow the business, as you develop it, money is required. And, you know, there's only so much loans you could get when you were by yourself. So actually, at some point in time, we were hitting roadblocks. The business was there, but financial roadblocks were, were something we were facing. So, you know, and that was, you know, rather than focusing on the growth of the business, we were focusing on the funding of the business. So, so that was a challenge. So I think it felt very good when we sold it and we found the right buyer. I think that was a very important element in our decision-making process.
So, you know, since you started it to, you know, the call centers, BPOs, KPOs, and so much evolvement, this whole thing has evolved so much. What are your thoughts on how this whole thing has evolved? Because from this being India's cutting edge, now it seems to have gone all over the world.
Yeah, I think what India has now done is that there are many phases, I mean, in all the things that you just mentioned, BPO, KPO, LPO, etc. And I think what has happened is that from about the late 90s, early 2000s, we were traditionally a voice-based business, right? But over the last 10 years, ever since we've sold the business, we've actually upscaled our services. So we've become far more involved in back office services, in analytics, in decision-making processes, which were never were given to India per se.
Yeah.
So I think there has been a morphing of the business over the last 10 years, value-added services, higher scale services. So I think that has been the progression. And the lower level of services, which are the call centers and the outbound selling, which is, of course, the lowest in the food chain, have actually now been outsourced to other cheaper countries. And I think that's the evolution of all businesses. You know, you start and we had English language as an advantage. So that is what I think we capitalized on, you know, in the 2000 to 2010 era. And then 2010 to now, we've actually been more in the slightly more value added services.
So moving on, you know, let's talk a little bit about ADMA and GEMS. I know you had told me you run a micro VC.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about this.
So what happened was that I sold my business to a British company called Circle. Mm-hmm. It's a very large British entity. And as every entrepreneur has, we had a 3-year sort of lock-in period, and which was very enjoyable in some parts and soul-destroying in other parts, but we can come to that later. But I retired after I spent my 3 years because our business earlier was an international business. So our customers would wake up in New Zealand and the clock would move to India, where our customers also were. And so New Zealand, Australia, India, and then carry on to Europe and onto the West Coast of the United States. So it is really a truly 24/7 service. And our average Monday to Friday working day was 16 hours. So honestly speaking, me and my wife in many ways were just burnt out, right? Having spent so much time, you know, nearly 10 years doing that. So we took a break. Well, she didn't take a break, but I took a break. And I got bored. I honestly got bored. There's only so much golf you can play. There's only so much bridge you can play. So I got bored and I thought to myself, what is a good thing to do? I had a colleague, I had somebody who used to work for me, came and said to me, will you become chairman of my company and invest? Which I did for about a year and a bit. I said, hey, this is a great idea. I sold my stake in that. I called up a few friends of mine and I said, hey, let's put some money together and start investing in, you know, in the startup world. So that happened in sort of March of 2016. And we call ourselves a micro VC fund only because we're small. We're very, very focused and targeted on what we do, companies that we invest in. So we have a bunch of friends that we formed a partnership with. And very specific, and the difference being that we do a lot of mentoring in the, in that whole journey. So that's really the micro VC fund.
I understand. So let's talk about your role as an angel investor. You know, you say you invest a lot, and we have a very, very large number of startup entrepreneurs who listen to our podcast and video podcast. So I'm sure they love listening to your advice. Raising money for a startup entrepreneur seems to be the biggest challenge.
True.
Also mentioned it when in your journey with InfoVision. What would be your advice to some of these people when they're looking to raise money?
I think, you know, I have fortunately given many talks on this subject. And I say there are probably between half a dozen to a dozen key attributes that you really need. I think the first two, I would say, is do you really have something that is disruptive, that, you know, catches the interest of your investor from the moment you walk in and you open your mouth? I mean, many people don't have an articulated plan, an articulated, you know, product or service that is actually going to make a difference. So one of the first questions I ask them, are you giving me oxygen or are you giving me just another B2? So are you really like an oxygen? Are you, I must have, right? The other thing that, you know, promoters don't really look at, but as investors I look at, is for us, 50% of our investment philosophy or criteria is based on the promoters themselves. Promoters have phenomenal ideas, right? Some of them come with the best ideas, but do they have the management capabilities? Do they have the execution capabilities? Do they actually have the rounded? I know it's difficult because they're young, but that is important to build a business. As much mentoring I can do, as much support we can give, but bottom line is that I can't be with them 24/7, right? So they have to have that rounded capability of managerial, come execution, capability, come technology oriented, this thing. So I think that's the second very, very important thing.
And, you know, you just mentioned that you're looking for oxygen and not normal air when the person comes for a business plan. But, you know, we also know that a very large number of startups don't make it.
True.
Right.
What would you ascribe that to?
I think two or three reasons. We have invested in many, and not all of our startups have survived. And if I were to just look at our own startup, this thing, I think most times they fall because they run out of money, as you said. I think one of the key issues that I have now come to learn from my association is that they have no financial acumen. I'm not saying zero, but very limited. You know, you will get a strategy person, you'll get a technology person, so a CTO, a CSO, a CMO. But has anybody thought of a CFO? I'm not suggesting that you go and hire a crore expensive CFO, but somebody who must actually watch your pennies, somebody who can tell you, listen, this is the way we are going, this is where we're going to run out of money, let's not do this, it's losing money. So, you know, I must say, we've invested in 14 startups till now. Not one of them has actually got a proper CFO. They've got some friend who's a CA and they go to them, but you really do need a financial acumen within your
someone who can provide the checks and balances.
Oh, absolutely. And tell you what is happening correctly, not correctly. How long is your burn? I mean, how long is your money going to last? Don't do this because you're just burning money, right? Etc. So I think that's one. And I think the other is, you know, it's just the fact that what they thought they had was oxygen, but really has run out because maybe the market has also changed. Maybe there's a pivot, or maybe the founders have not been able to pivot, you know, and found the
So continuing with your experience of investing, I speak to so many people who come and talk on a podcast, and I always ask them, do you think a startup should have a single founder or should they be co-founders? And I get diverse views. What is your experience?
My experience is best two, three also desirable, but no more.
Okay.
And I don't agree.
And one
I don't agree with at all. Because you're putting too many eggs in one basket. The one founder, you don't know. You know, you've invested money into the one founder. Yes, you may have one lead founder, and that's always important. But we would really, really be pushed to put our money into one founder only. I might add that out of our 14 investments, we have one where there is one founder, but all 13 of ours were not one founders.
Wow.
They had co-founders. That we also find that if there are more than three, right, it becomes a bit of a mess, right? So ideally, between two and three is our sweet spot, right?
Wonderful.
And that has worked for us.
Wonderful. So one more question on startups, and that also relates to failure.
Right.
I'm working on a new book on failure. So, and I've been talking to a lot of startups. One of the challenges in our country, and I think in most countries, is that parents don't teach children the meaning and the relevance of understanding failure. That leads to serious challenges. It manifests itself in on our roads. Everyone wants to be on the front. When on a plane with the Indians lands, everyone wants to get off first, etc., etc. But it also leads to startup entrepreneurs, in some cases, taking the extreme step, as we have seen. What are your thoughts on failure?
Well, I think what you make are valid points. I think one area of failure is that to be able to sense, right, when things are not going correctly. And the problem is most founders leave it too late. And however much mentorship we may give them, you know, it goes through one ear and out of the other. You know, as they always say, you want to hear what you want to hear.
Correct.
Right. So sometimes hearing the truth is not something that they want to imbibe. Mm-hmm. Right. Secondly, I think what is very important is that, and it's part of the culture, it's part of it, is that they are so strong because of their intellectual capability that they're only focused on that success. They're not focused on what can go wrong.
Correct.
And it's very important for them to focus on what can go wrong. I mean, I can tell you virtually to the last degree, out of my 14 startups, not one of them have met their revenue targets as they had forecast, but all of them have met their cost targets, right? So the question is how, you know, things in our country don't move in the same pace as elsewhere, right? You may not get your contracts on time. You would never get paid on time, right? So these are challenges of the country that, as you say, parents don't teach you, although they have been through it themselves in their own careers, right? They never say to them. And I think it's important to have confidence, but it's important to have confidence that is that has a realm of reality around it. Usually confidence is, you know, I'm on cloud nine, thank you very much. I'm smarter than the rest of the crowd and I'll make it.
Correct.
And that doesn't always work.
I agree.
And I think coming down to earth is very, very important. And really the first coming down to earth is when they start seeing that they're running out of money. That is their first reality check.
Correct.
And from being arrogant, there is a humility that starts coming into it. So I'm not suggesting as a, to startups that, you know, have that, but I'm saying that have humility and learn from people who are older than you, the mistakes they have made.
Correct.
And learn from that. Doesn't happen today.
Correct.
That doesn't happen. And you know, as much as you can teach them, I'm sorry, you know, I have a lot of respect and regard for young folks today because they take risks we never in our time thought of taking. So there's a lot of respect for them. But I suppose with age and gray hair, you have a few
wisdom.
Learnings. So that would, is what I would say about failure.
No, those are very wise words indeed. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people will hear and understand you. So moving on to another subject, which relates to, again, people like you and me of our vintage. You mentioned that when you sold InfoVision, you decided to take a break and you got bored.
Yes, sir.
And the subject of superannuation in India is almost a taboo.
Yes.
Nobody wants to talk about it. So when I speak to people in 57, 58, and I say, what are you going to do after 2 years? Because your life post 60, given today's health, will be almost equal to your working life.
Yes.
Have you planned anything? And they said, no. You have done a lot of things post-retirement and you are extremely busy. What would be your advice to people on when they should start planning for second innings?
So, you know, this was a lesson I learned, you know, from two events or incidents. One was that I remember when I was in ICL, and as I said, I was the financial controller. We were told by HR, I'm talking about probably 80s or something, can you put or make a provision in the budget for retirement advice and guidance? And I thought to myself, you know, I was a young lad of 34, 35 at that time. And retirement was nowhere on the horizon or you know, joking, I couldn't even spell the word. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Right? And that was the first time I realized that a sensible organization actually understands this is a dilemma most people come up with. And how do you actually work towards it? So that opened my eyes to the thought of saying, hey, you know, and I looked at what the course was and what the material was and why we were spending this money. And it was very important to try to understand and from an earlier stage. So this was not folks who were already 60. Mm-hmm. And these were folks who were 50. Mm-hmm. 10 years before their retirement, this was a 10-year program to actually help you understand what retirement is and to understand and to actually pull out from your inner self what your true desires were and your true to wants when, right? So I think that was my first exposure. I think the second item was that I don't think we actually understand that we will retire. We don't, we hit 60 or 65, depending on which part of the world you are. You suddenly wake up one morning and you, this thing. So I must just share a very interesting story with you. Many years ago, when I was in Dubai, we invited a couple who at that time was the head of Polaroid there. And he was 70. And he said, and I said, you know, what's happening? And he said, oh, we are going to China. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, I said, John, I mean, you're already 70. Why have you not retired? So he said, I did retire 3-4 years ago. And we bought a little cottage in the Midlands. Mm-hmm. And after 6 months, my wife said to me, I married you for better or for worse, but not for lunch every day. So get out of the house and work. So I think these three or four things over my life have actually left me with the belief that you must plan for your retirement. And I think what you need to do is you need to actually start focusing on what your interests are. And, you know, you must have, in my opinion, you must have an outdoor hobby. You must have an indoor hobby. And you must identify what keeps your mind alive. Mm-hmm. It really is your mind that needs to be kept active. And if you wake up on your 60th year, the start of your 61st year, and say to yourself, what am I going to do? Because you've just been so consumed with your work till that day, till the day you retire. I think that's too late. I think you have to really start at least 5 years before. Embrace the fact that you're going to retire. Don't live in cloud cuckoo land. Correct. That you're going to be, you know, extended for the next 10 years.
Correct.
Right? And actually start planning. And I think to the day I sold my business, I said to myself, yes, I have 3 years to work, but let me try to do what I'm doing. My retirement was more to do with just recharging batteries because, you know, I mean, we'd worked so many hours every single day for so long that, you know, it was like double your working life.
Correct.
So I think I retired, but I knew what I wanted to do. I knew, broadly speaking, the areas I wanted to get involved in. Mm-hmm. So when I got the opportunity, I took that opportunity and pursued that. And honestly speaking, today I'm very, very busy.
I can imagine.
I'm busy and I'm very happy that I'm busy. Yeah. And I'm very happy that I'm able to contribute, right? Not just financially, but intellectually with the experience we have for young startups.
Wonderful. So Aditya, one last question for you.
Yeah.
We've spoken about lots of learnings, spoken about your investments, about startups. What has been your learnings from some of your failures or mistakes?
So I think I would say two, right? You know, I'm not a details person. I look at the vision.
Despite being a finance person.
Finance, I'm detailed to the core. Okay. I mean, you can give me a sheet of an Excel sheet with numbers on it. I'll pick out the problem.
I was just kidding.
Yeah. But, you know, but other than that, I think, you know, I think what happens is that you become, you know, the more vision, where are you going, the more marketing, the more sort of thing. And I think one of my failures is that I was not a completely detailed out of the nitty gritty. So I could take the company forward, which I did, right? And I realized that for me, I must have somebody who's actually a very important person who can actually manage the detail, the operations, the delivery. And I was very fortunate, I must say, that my wife and I worked together. So she provided that acumen and that expertise. So I think that's one of my failures, that lack of understanding. I think the other thing is that I did not stick to my own preaching insofar as that I always said, you must stick to the knitting, you know, as we all have said. Mm. And what your core expertise is, you must do. But you know, sometimes, especially after you retire, what happens is somebody comes and says, hey, let's make an investment in this or that, or let's go down this route. And you do that and you forget the fact that you must stick to the knitting.
Correct.
Don't get involved in something that you know nothing about, right? And I think that has been a failure where I've done it now. Hopefully, I'm not going to do it again. but I think I think those are issues that are important. So I'd say stick to the knitting. If you don't know anything about it, don't do the thing. Mm-hmm. And when you build your business, ensure that you know what your strengths are and find somebody who can support you in the strengths you don't have. Because none of us have all the strengths of this thing.
Correct.
So I would say on reflection, those are my two things that come to mind immediately.
Terrific. Right. Aditya, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
What an absolute pleasure it is to speak to you. And good luck with all the new ventures.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.